in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest Foods, celebrating 15 years of serving the community and 5 years at their current location, with an anniversary tasting event on Saturday, April 2nd from 10 to 5. Over 100 items will be featured, including cheeses, olives, chocolates, baklava, and more. World Harvest at the intersection of 6th and University, Champaign.
Seven minutes past 1 o'clock Central Time. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. Two tax experts join us today. Our guests are Marty Verdick and Steve Winterstein of RSM McGladrey Incorporated. So if you have questions about your Illinois or federal tax return, they can help. Today is the day to give us a call here on the Afternoon Magazine. Marty is a CPA and Managing Director of Tax Services for RSM McGladrey. Steve Winterstein is a CPA and manager with RSM McGladrey's tax department. So if you've got a tax question, give us a call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, call toll-free. Use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Welcome back. Good to see you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
We've already got a couple of listeners waiting to talk with the two of you, so let's go right away to our first listener, our first caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. I have been buying AT&T stock on a dividend reinvestment plan, and how does one figure out what your tax basis is? If you're going to sell, when, you know, sometimes I would just get a fractional share each quarter for the dividend. How do you figure that?
Okay. What happens is that you really have two components to your basis in this case. The first would be your original purchase of the AT&T stock, and the second would be the additional shares that you've purchased through the dividend reinvestment plan or a DRIP plan.
Uh-huh.
As you reinvest the dividends, it's, if you think of it as receiving cash from the company for your dividends and then using that cash to buy additional stock, using that analogy, it's fairly clear. I think you'll see that the additional shares that you purchase, you do have basis in those shares equal to the purchase price of those shares at the time of the reinvestment. You need to keep track of that. Mutual funds do a fairly good job of tracking basis, but individual stocks with dividend reinvestment plans are not quite as user-friendly. You do need to track that, and when you sell the stock, you have a couple of choices on how to calculate basis if you don't sell all of the stock. You're either allowed to use a first-in, first-out method, or what most people use and what most stock funds use would be an average cost basis method, where you take your total number of shares and the total dollar basis, divide shares into basis, and come up with an average cost per share when you sell it.
Okay.
It's not an easy process.
No, it really is confusing.
You have to take your original cost, your original investment, and you have to add up all the reinvested dividends for every year. Typically, AT&T and other companies will send you an annual statement, so you'll have your summary for the year, but you have to add those numbers up and do a running total to know what your total basis is.
Okay. Now, the shares happen to have been ones that I inherited. Is my basis for those the day the person died or the day that it was transferred to me?
It would be the date of death, generally. There is an alternative valuation date available, but generally it's going to be the date of death value for the shares that you inherited. Now, any shares you acquired after that date would be your purchase price.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Next week. Turn my mic on. That would help. Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign, line two. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I also have a cost basis question, which was partially answered. The additional wrinkle that I would add is inheritance where the stock is still held in a trust.
Okay.
How is the cost basis determined?
Well, it depends on the nature of the trust and whether or not the assets in that trust were included in the estate of the decedent. If it was a living trust or a grantor trust, then those assets would generally be would be included in the estate of the decedent. On the other hand, there are certain types of irrevocable trusts where the assets that are in that trust and the value of the trust is not included in the decedent's estate and therefore would not get a step up in basis.
It would. My situation would be the latter.
Okay. If there was no step-up in basis as a result of the fact that the trust was not included in the estate of the decedent, then the basis in those shares of stock owned by the trust goes back to the basis of the grantor or the contributor to the trust. And that can be a monumental task, figuring out what that might be.
So back to the original purchase.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Other questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Two tax pros joining us this afternoon from RSM McGladrey, Marty Verdick, and Steve Winterstein. I have a question that I received by email today. Here it is. My wife has a small business where she pays rent for an office. In preparing our taxes, we just learned that she may need to file a Form 1099 MISC, which I assume is miscellaneous, with the IRS and the payee of the rent, the landlord. Since we missed the deadline, what should we do?
Well, that's an excellent question. She's right. Once the amount's over $600 and paid to the landlord, other than a corporation, she is required to fill out a 1099 MISC or miscellaneous, if you will. And there's a box there for rents, so she would fill that out. I wouldn't recommend that she send it in at this point. She should make a note every year after this, though, to make sure that she has it filed timely. And this would be a little bit late. There's a penalty for filing late that $50 per occurrence would probably result in about $100, actually, for late filing. And we recommend that she just make a note of it and make sure she does it next year.
Next year, okay. And it's over $600 or over?
Yes, it's only required for payments in excess of $600 for the calendar year. And the penalty is $50 per failure to provide a 1099 to the recipient or to the landlord, and $50 per failure to provide the 1099 to the government. And the due date for this, you are supposed to have the 1099s to the landlord by the end of January, and you're supposed to then file the 1099s with the government by the end of February. So they are about four weeks late now. If one were to file that 1099 now, you've essentially guaranteed that you would get a late filing notice and penalty from the government.
Okay, so keep it in mind for
make
next
a note.
Year.
Yep.
Okay. Why is the government interested in this information?
Well, they want to make sure that the income gets reported. With things like rent and with self-employment income, they want to make sure that this income does in fact get reported on people's tax returns. And so they place a burden on the people paying rent or paying for services to report that to the government. Now, they do have a de minimis amount, the $600 threshold, below which you don't have to do that. But and also, this filing requirement only applies for payments in connection with a business. This particular person mentioned that they rented space in mm-hmm. connection with their business. If you are simply paying rent on an apartment or on a home, you don't have a filing requirement. It only applies to payments that are business-related.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
All right, I'm going to try not to sound as idiotic as I feel about this, so we'll see how it goes. I sold items at a craft fair, mm-hmm. items which were purchased retail.
Okay.
All right, so which means I paid tax on them.
Sales tax at the time of purchase.
Yes, that's mm-hmm. correct. And sales tax was collected on the items that were sold at the craft fair.
Okay.
So how do I calculate my expenses? I mean, is there any way I can take off the tax that I've already paid on the raw materials for what was sold?
Well, you what amount did you collect sales tax on the entire sales price?
Yes.
Okay. Because you collected that sales tax, and it is appropriate, by the way, that you did collect sales tax,
right.
That amount has to be remitted to the state of Illinois
okay.
because you collected it under the pretext that it is sales tax, and,
okay.
it's, and it is. You collected it appropriately.
Okay.
Now, when computing your cost to determine your profit, mm-hmm. you would include the sales tax that you paid in the cost of that material. So if you bought $100 worth of product, so the total cost was $107.50 because of sales tax, and you sold that for, let's say, $200, your profit would be the $92.50 difference.
Gotcha.
Now, if this is something that you're going to be doing in the future, you could avoid paying that sales tax at the time of purchase by providing the merchant with what is called a reseller certificate. In other words, you've apparently registered to collect sales tax and remit sales tax to the state of Illinois, and you have a sales tax ID number?
Actually not. This was done, it was a group sale, so that it was collected under the umbrella organization.
Okay, well then you would, if you were to obtain your own reseller number,
so that's what needs to be done.
Then you could provide that reseller number to the merchant, and you would not be subject to sales tax at the time of purchase.
Okay.
Since you don't have one, the merchant is going to tax you on your raw materials, and when you sell the product through this group, they are going to collect sales tax on the whole thing. But the sales tax that you paid, you can deduct in computing your taxable income from the sale.
Okay. That's all I needed to know. Okay. Thank you for putting it so clearly.
Okay. You're welcome.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Other questions are invited. No one is waiting at the moment. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. I was stunned by this. I learned this morning looking over some tax pages on the web that the average refund this year so far is $2,436. How many people receive refunds? And you really don't want to have that kind of money coming in, you know, so late in the day, do you?
Well, essentially, anyone who receives a refund, there are a couple of different ways of looking at this. First of all, it really is nothing more than an interest-free loan to the government.
Right.
Because they do refund the money, but it is without interest. On the other hand, most people would prefer to receive a refund of a couple thousand dollars than owe a couple thousand dollars.
Right.
For two reasons. One, in many respects, people view it as almost a forced savings plan. And it's a lot easier to put a few thousand dollars away into savings if you get it all at once than if you get an extra $100 every paycheck throughout the course of the year. It seems to disappear. So some people intentionally overpay. They like doing that. Certainly from a cash flow standpoint, you're better off estimating accurately what your tax liability is going to be and having that amount withheld. But that's not always easy to do. And most people tend to err on the side of being conservative because they'd much rather get a refund. It's amazing when I'll call a client and, you know, I'll explain that they owe X amount, and they would much rather get a call that says, gee, you have a refund of the same amount, even though, as I explained to them, you've really made an interest-free loan to the government.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to either just get a tiny refund or, just a tiny bit.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
You want to be just perfect with it.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. A toll-free line, Normal, Illinois, line 4. Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. First one is a sale of stock. It was an insurance, and we sold it and got the money. And I'm not sure where to list that as income.
Okay.
I didn't think it was part of Schedule A.
Well, no, it would. If it's a sale of stock, it will go on Schedule D.
D?
D is in Delta.
Okay.
And it will be either a long-term or a short-term capital gain, depending upon how long you've held the stock in the insurance policy.
Okay.
My guess is that you received this stock as part of a demutualization of the insurance company.
It was an insurance policy, and we cashed it in.
Oh, now that's different than selling stock.
Okay.
It truly was just an insurance policy that you had that had accumulated cash surrender value, and you cashed that policy in?
I believe so, but, you know, the description says sale of stock.
Okay.
Prudential Commons, but I'm sure it was an insurance.
Oh, did you say Prudential?
Yes.
Ah, okay. Then it was Prudential a few years ago went through what's called a demutualization, and its policyholders received shares of stock in the Prudential company.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to have been one of those policyholders, so I'm familiar with this. You do actually own shares of stock in Prudential, and when you sell those shares of stock, the sales proceeds will be considered gain because there is no basis in that stock. You didn't buy it. You didn't pay for it anywhere along the way. It just occurred as a result of having a policy. And it will go on Schedule D. It's probably going to be a long-term capital gain, which is a holding period of 1 year or more. And that gain will be taxed at a maximum rate of 15%. And the calculation of that tax actually is fairly tricky. So I would caution you when you do your tax return to be very careful with that capital gain calculation, because it's fairly confusing.
How so?
Oh, when you go to the Schedule D worksheet for calculating the tax, it is not the easiest thing to work your way through. It's just it's a lot of references to a lot of different line numbers, and it can be confusing.
Right. I would have to go. Oh, okay. I'm not looking at the right one. Okay.
It's confusing because you're trying to tax that gain at 15%, and other income that you have maybe taxed at a different rate. And so the form, Schedule D, takes you through the different steps, but it is very tedious.
Yeah. All right. I'll look through that.
Okay.
My other question is about health savings plans, and I'm trying to figure out whether I qualify or not, and I couldn't make heads or tails of that. Form 8889.
You're talking about a medical savings account?
Yes.
Well, do you have earned income? Are you employed?
Well, this is my husband.
Okay.
Yes. And we have a health savings plan through his work where he takes out so much per month or per paycheck, and then, you know, we use that for any kind of medical bills that we have.
Okay. I suspect what he has is a cafeteria plan that it's called a cafeteria plan because you can choose a variety of benefits under it, much like a cafeteria. And I'm guessing that what he has is a flexible spending account, or an account where he can set aside dollars for the reimbursement or for the payment of medical expenses. And that's different than a true health savings plan.
Okay.
But if he has that opportunity, he certainly should consider using it. The thing to be careful of with a true cafeteria plan through your employer is that generally those are set up so that you either use it or lose it. So if you set aside at the beginning of the year, you designate an amount that you want to go into this plan, let's say $2,000.
Right.
Over the course of the year, if you don't have medical expenses, unreimbursed medical expenses that rise to that level that you can use up the $2,000, whatever is left is going to be lost.
Yes, I know that. I'm
okay.
Aware of. So that's not the same as this.
No. No, it's not.
That's something completely different, because I know that's pre-tax, so
yeah.
I didn't know why.
Yeah, if the plan you have is through your husband's employer, that's different than this the health savings account that you're referring to.
Uh-huh. My next question is, I am a subcontractor, so I get a 1099 form,
mm-hmm.
and so then I have to calculate my Social Security.
Your self-employment tax, that's right.
My self-employment tax.
Right.
And that's fine, but I just received my Social Security statement that you get yearly or every so often.
Right.
And they don't have anything down there for that. It didn't list any of that self-employment tax.
Well, are you referring to your earnings statement where you get sort of a history of your earnings?
Right.
Okay. Have you had this in the past?
Have you had your company in the past?
The self-employment income?
Yes.
Okay.
The last 3 years I've had, you know, gotten a 1099 statement from this one company.
And have you been reporting it on your tax return
yes.
as self-employment income?
Yes.
If that's the case, then it sounds like you need to contact the Social Security Administration, because it should reflect that self-employment income
okay.
on your earnings statement.
That's what I thought.
Yep.
So. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Bye. Thanks for the call. So if you don't use that money that's in your cafeteria plan, where does it go?
Basically, it reverts back to the employer, and they use it to reduce administrative expenses of the plan.
Oh, okay. Let's talk with another listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yes. What is the maximum medical deduction for a married couple?
Well, the maximum medical deduction? There is no maximum. There are thresholds that you have to exceed before you can receive any benefit from the medical expense deduction.
I guess that's what I'm asking.
Okay. That is, and it's the same whether it's for a single individual or a married couple.
Oh.
Before it gets included in your itemized deduction calculation, it has to exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. and only the excess, over 7.5% of this adjusted gross income, gets included in the calculation of your itemized deductions.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a big number. Most people don't benefit from the medical deduction because of that 7.5% threshold.
Yeah. Yeah, even if you have a lot of expenses.
It's 7.5% of your adjusted gross income adds up pretty fast.
That answered my question.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Yeah, so if you had $100,000 gross income, you'd need to have
$7,500 of medical expenses.
$7,501 or
yeah,
something.
And then you don't get $1. I mean, it's only the excess over 7.5% that provides any tax benefit.
Oh,
so
only those medical expenses that weren't reimbursed by insurance.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, insurance premiums do get included in that total, but still it's I would say it's very unusual. It's rare that I see someone that actually benefits from medical expense deductions, unless in some cases like elderly people in a nursing home where it's medically required, that adds up in a hurry.
Yeah, sure does. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Indiana on line 2. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have received that government publication 600. That 600. Is there any way that you can take advantage of every state is scaled, so if you have a certain income, it's worth so much to you if you can use it. But if you have paid to the state already on income tax, then this is for Indiana. Is there any way of filling out the government forms that you still have to use Schedule A, which is Schedule A 1040. You have to use that, which is an itemized deduction sheet,
Yes, you would determine whether or not your sales tax, based on your income, there's a table.
Yeah,
you get a certain amount of sales tax that might be deducted. And you'd compare that to the state income taxes you paid, and you would look to see which one is higher.
Okay, now, pardon me just a second.
Go ahead.
You look at both of them, and you look at what you have already paid to the state, what's been taken out, and this is in the family here, and my daughter, she has paid $1,400 state tax, and that table shows that this whole thing's only worth $600 and some on the Indiana State table for $41,000. So you can make a choice, huh?
Yes, you would choose the higher of the two, of course. You would add to your sales tax. You would add to that $600 some number if you had purchased a large item like an automobile, because that has sales tax as well. And
yeah,
you could
right.
add that to the sales tax that's based on income, in this case $600 some. But in the end, you would take all the sales tax and you would compare that to your income tax, state income tax paid, and you would take the higher of the two.
Look at your form to show how much has been deducted for state income tax. And you compare that with what's on the table?
Yes, sir.
That's right. And then that becomes, the larger of those two becomes part of your itemized deductions, and you only do benefit from either one of those if you actually itemize deductions.
I noticed on number five, you have to choose for income or for sales tax.
That's right. You get to choose one or the other, and naturally you'd pick the higher of the two. And then it only provides benefit if, in fact, you do itemize deductions. If you take the standard deduction, it doesn't help you any.
I guess that was really my question. You're going to have to fill out that
Schedule A.
1050A.
Yep, Schedule A.
Okay. One person asked a while ago about how much medical expense could be deducted. That falls also into the same set of deductions and stuff for church and stuff that you contribute to churches and places like that.
It's all part of your itemized deductions, and contributions are one of the itemized deduction categories, as well as medical and state and local tax and mortgage interest, yes.
Does that still have that same amount that you have to get beyond a certain amount?
No, the 7.5% threshold only applies to medical expenses. Contributions don't have any threshold like that, but you still have to be able to itemize before it provides you with any tax benefit.
You're still going to have to itemize.
Yep.
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Good luck. Next, we talk with a listener in Danville on line 3. Hi.
Hello. I have one brief comment before my question. Don't you think that an average refund that seems so high does not represent an excess of income tax payments, but rather the child tax credit and earned income credit and things like that that apply when you file your return?
Certainly, they could be made up of a combination of excess withholding or any of these credits. Now,
well, yes.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is I don't think it's all excess withholding.
It depends on a particular situation.
Sure.
And, you know, the credits that you're mentioning, the child credit and the earned income credit, are phased out for many taxpayers, and they don't get any benefit from those based upon their level of income.
That is true, but they would then be figured when you figure the average.
Absolutely.
Sure, certainly.
No,
yeah.
Your point's well taken.
Yep.
Point's
okay.
Well taken. Those do
My
factor in.
My question is involving items that are given to charity other than cash payments. And I have just recently sent some items to a charity, and instead of using them for their own use, since they had historic value, they wanted to sell them on eBay, and they would give me a letter giving me, you know, the proceeds of the sale, which sounds fine. I did, however, incur almost $50 of expenses in mailing these items to them. Next year when I do my taxes, could I also include those mailing expenses?
You know, Steve and I are looking at each other. I believe the answer to that is yes. And the reason I say that is I've had situations where an individual has shipped clothing or other items to an area needing relief, for example, down to Florida for hurricane victims. And I seem to recall that the cost of getting the donated items to the destination is includable. But I, you know, that's one I would want to look up to be absolutely certain.
Well, I've got almost a year to do it, but I just wonder, because in the instance where you're sending clothing, they're not selling it for a $600 or $700
right.
To give you. But anyway, well,
yeah.
I'm pondering that.
I think I'd be inclined to do that unless I could find something that specifically said otherwise.
Yes.
To take it or not?
To take it.
To take it.
All right.
Take it.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. You know, this caller mentioned a couple of tax credits that might be of real use to folks.
Mm-hmm.
You want to just give us a kind of a quick summary?
Sure. The child credit is a credit that is available to families with children, as the name would imply, and that credit is phased out based upon a person's level of income. It is not available to everyone. And offhand, Steve, can you want to check those the income amounts while I talk about the earned income credit? The earned income credit is a credit that is also available to taxpayers who have lower levels of earnings, but you do have to have, as the name implies, earned income to obtain this credit. If you maintain a home for a child, that level of income is higher than if you don't. But these are credits which a major distinction between the two is the child credit is not a refundable credit. In other words, let's say that the child credit is $1,000, but the individual only has $700 of total tax liability before the credit. What happens is that you can only reduce the taxable or the tax liability to zero. So you're not going to get money back from the child credit. The earned income credit, on the other hand, is a refundable credit, meaning that it's treated just like taxes that you might have paid. So it's like withholding. So I had a return I looked at not long ago. They had no tax liability, but yet they got and they had no withholding on their income, but yet they got a refund because of this earned income credit.
Yeah.
Steve, have you got the numbers?
Yes, I do. The child credit, which is usually $1,000 a child up to a couple children, is phased out for income. Joint filers gets phased out when their AGI is over $110,000.
Mm-hmm.
And for single filers, when their income exceeds $75,000, they solely phase it out.
Okay.
Okay. And that earned income credit, I understand that a lot of people don't take advantage of it.
It is one that is easily missed in preparing the tax return, and it's something that you do need to look at carefully to make sure that you don't miss that.
Okay, let's talk with another listener. Caller in Terre Haute on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. As usual, it's a wonderful program. It turns out I figured my taxes, and I'm going to owe $3,500.
Okay, so you're not one of those average people getting a $2,400 refund this year.
No, well, it's not important why I got that. But then somebody said I can have deductions for expenses I made when I accompanied my pastor on a mission trip to Russia. I went to Russia. I'm a professional interpreter, mm-hmm. and I didn't charge anything. And she went to give a series of lectures, so I went and interpreted for her. I paid my own hotel. I paid my own airfare.
Okay.
And normally, I do this all the time, and I just pass it off. But since I've got this whopping amount of money I owe, I want to get every deduction I can. So can I deduct this, and what kind of proof do I need? Because I didn't save any of the receipts from the hotel and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, generally, expenses that you incur in connection with transportation or travel related to a charity, as long as you are an official or an approved representative of that charity. So, for example, if you're on let's say that you're an elder in your church or a member of the session, whatever governing council you have, and you attend a meeting in connection with that, the costs of attending that meeting, including your travel and meals and lodging and everything, would be deductible. In this particular case, I think that you've got a very good argument that if you were accompanying your pastor in connection with service to the church that he represents, that your out-of-pocket costs for that would be a tax-deductible item. Now, in order to be deductible, contributions have to be made to U.S. charities, so that's why I preface it by saying that assuming that he's going in his capacity as a minister of this church as opposed to providing services to a Russian charity.
No.
But you are not permitted to deduct anything for the value of your time, but your actual out-of-pocket costs, such as airfare, hotels, lodging, and so on, I believe you would be able to take those as a charitable contribution. Do you agree, Steve?
Yeah, I do agree. I think the key is that the church has to sponsor him. And mm-hmm. in other words, if you're part of Kiwanis or some other large charitable organizations and you incur out-of-pocket costs, hotel bills and airfare and that type of thing, when you're out-of-pocket like that, not your time, but mm-hmm. out-of-pocket, and the U.S. charity is sponsoring you, yes, or sponsoring the event, then I think the answer is yes.
And the other caution I would have is you do have to look at the primary purpose of the trip. If you went to Russia for, let's say, 3 weeks, and the charitable portion of that was 3 days, you would not be permitted to deduct your actual travel costs, the airline cost back and forth. You would only be able to deduct the direct costs relating to the days that you were there for charitable purposes.
Okay. I have now, what kind of documentation do I need? I have a letter from the church.
Well, that would certainly be a starting point, but the letter is only going to designate you as kind of an authorized representative of the church doing this. You would need to be able to go back and determine your actual out-of-pocket costs, and hopefully you might have credit card statements or something along those lines that you could look at. I'm guessing that expenses in Russia, at least on my credit card bill, would show up. I would be able to pick them out pretty mm-hmm. easily.
Yeah. Hopefully
you used a credit card for that, and that's what I would use since you don't have any receipts.
Did you write checks or did you use credit card?
Well, it's hard to write checks in Russia.
Yep.
Well, I don't know if you paid for it ahead of time.
Take credit cards. So a lot of places I paid cash.
Well, I would do the best that you can to reconstruct your expenses.
Okay. Do I need to submit those?
No. No, you do not need to submit them with the tax return. You just need to be able to produce them upon audit, or at least tell a convincing story.
Okay, the dog ate it.
Or something. You had a flood, whatever it might be.
Okay. Okay, and that goes under the place where I put down, I tithe. I pay to the mm-hmm. church regularly. That's under the same line as
mm-hmm.
that?
Yep, exactly. It's an out-of-pocket expense incurred in connection with the charity.
And that's what I label it?
Yep.
Okay, I don't do it on a Schedule C or anything?
No, it goes on Schedule A with your other charitable deductions.
Okay. Because I am a professional.
Yep. No, that's it. But this particular service was done in connection with the charitable organization, so that's
and
where it
I
goes.
And I can't deduct my, like, my time.
No. No, no value given to your time.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener. Champaign, line one. Hi.
Good afternoon. This is the situation. Someone holds shares in a mutual fund that have been held long-term, and the mutual company merges those shares into another new mutual fund and assures the holder that the exchange is tax-free. What is the rule on if one sells those within the next year? Are they long-term based on the original holdings, or are they short-term based on the exchange?
Well, the rule generally is that if basis carries over, in other words, if it's not a taxable transaction, which is in and of itself is a question I guess I would look into a little bit farther, but if it was a non-taxable transaction, the general rule is that if basis carries over, holding period carries over. That would be the general rule. Now, if you know, when you talk about merging funds, it is certainly possible for the mutual fund company to have done that in a tax-free manner. I don't know what particular fund you're talking about, but one thing that many people are confused by is situations where they might move money from one mutual fund to another, but within the same company. For example, they might move it from a small cap fund into an international fund. That is a taxable event, but if it's something that the mutual fund does, it's certainly possible for that to be a tax-free transaction, just an internal restructuring. But I, without knowing more details, I would tell you that the general rule is that if basis carries over, holding period would carry over.
All right. Thank you very much.
Exactly right.
Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana on line two. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
My question has to do with donations to a charity, as someone did also. We recently gave a lot of items from an elderly person, including some furniture, to a charity. And I have no idea how those would have been valued. They gave me a piece of paper that I could make a list on. Would I estimate the cost at what they sold it for, or a percentage of that? Let's say they put $50 on an item. Would I be able to use the $50 number, or do I use a half that, or how do you do this?
Oh, you actually know what their charity is?
I went and I looked because I had no idea how, just out of curiosity, what it would sell for. But if I, you know, how do you do that?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. Thrift shop value is often a value that's used in determining the charitable deduction for clothing, for example, and that is very difficult for lay people to try and estimate. But you've done the best thing possible. Mm-hmm. You actually figured out what thrift shop value would be in those cases. You have to do the estimating, and you've done the very best because you've actually come up with the value that they were trying to sell it for.
So you can actually use the number that they put on it to sell it for.
As long as that's less than the original cost. Yes.
Oh yeah.
Of course.
Okay.
The answer is yes.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
I recall, I hope correctly, several minutes ago, an elderly chap called in from, I think, Indiana. And I wonder if he and you folks were a little bit off base, although pretty darn close. He kept talking about the Indiana caller. I think it was his daughter.
Yes.
Or his wife, someone
his daughter.
Like that. And the question was sales tax charged by Indiana theoretically versus actual state income tax paid, if I have the right caller. I had the sense, and I may be wrong, that he was looking at, in fact, I think he said, withheld, as opposed to line 36 or whatever, actual tax liability.
Yeah.
Which of the two, withheld in advance or the actual eventual calculated tax liability, should you be advising the Indiana chap if he's still listening?
Well, it's actually it may be neither of those two. The state income tax deduction that you would get on Schedule A is made up of the actual state tax that you paid during the calendar year. Withholding is tax That does represent tax actually paid during the year. There could be other items such as a balance due on a prior year tax return that was paid in April of the year that would be included in that calculation. So you do not get to deduct the computed tax liability because let's say that you have a balance due on your subsequent Indiana return.
Yeah, let's say $3,000 was withheld and another $1,000 was due, making
your,
a total of four.
Your deduction would be three, not four, because the extra $1,000 balance due wouldn't be paid until April 15th of 2005. So that $1,000 would be deducted on your 2005 return.
Wow.
Now let's say that in the prior year.
So you have to go back and pick up, say, there was an extra $800 a year earlier.
Precisely
that's,
right.
That's exactly right. You have to go back to the 2003 return that you filed in April of 2004 to see what you paid.
And any estimated payments that might be made, because some people make quarterly estimates.
Sure.
And only those quarterly estimates. So you're absolutely right, caller. You got that exactly right. It's the amount paid during the year, and withholding is considered paid during the year.
My reading of that caller was that he was focusing entirely on one thing, the amount that had been withheld. Probably it showed up on something or other.
It would have probably
and
showed up on a W-2
form. Changing himself a wee bit.
It's possible.
It's possible, yes. Good point. Excellent
Thank you.
Point.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We just have a couple minutes left. Maybe we could get in one more call, 333-9455-800-222-9455. Deductions people are likely to miss, to forget about, to not know about.
Well, one that gets missed a lot, I think, are the non-cash contributions. You know, people clean out their closets. They take things to Empty Tomb or Goodwill or Salvation Army, and they lose track of that. It's not a big number, but certainly it's something that people need to remember. Charitable contributions in general. You know, the $5 here and $10 there, somebody at work is taking up a collection for the American Cancer Society or whatever. Yeah, keep track of all of those things because typically you don't get receipts in that situation. Typically it's cash out of pocket, but yet over the course of the year it can add up to be a significant number. It's one of the few deductions that you have that you don't receive something that documents it, such as mortgage interest. Well, you get a statement telling you what it is. Real estate taxes, it's pretty easy to figure out what it is. Contributions would be one that I think are easily overlooked.
Okay. Our last caller this afternoon is joining us on a cell phone, line 4. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. And my question is about charitable contributions.
Okay.
I know you have several of them, but they didn't quite answer mine completely.
Okay.
We do a lot of fundraisers where I work, and a lot of them aren't like just giving cash as the gift. We give things that are sold at a silent auction.
Okay.
And also we do like backpacks for kids starting school. We fill the backpacks with items and things. Can we count those as deductions?
Sure. Is this... For example, you go down to your local store and buy the materials that you then put into the backpacks that are used as the donation. Is that the question?
Yes.
If you buy merchandise that is used in a charitable purpose, such as you're describing, the cost of that merchandise is deductible. Another good example would be, let's say that your church has a youth group and you provide food for that youth group on every Sunday morning, you know, snacks, whatever it might be. The cost of that merchandise, the food, the products that are put in the backpack, are considered charitable contributions, and you do get to take that deduction.
All right. Thank you very much, and have a great day.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, that'll do it, I guess. And if you got any parting thoughts?
Oh, everything is due 2 weeks from Friday.
Wow.
Not that we're counting, but the days are numbered, so it's time. One of the funniest things that I've ever done is after the 15th, the evening or early evening, late afternoon of the 15th of April is to go by the public library and watch all of the people scrambling to pick up their tax forms and literally sitting on the floor trying to do their tax returns. Don't get caught up in that group.
Oh, boy.
Too many chances of making a mistake.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us once again. It's always a pleasure to talk with the two of you.
Thanks for having us.
Our guests this afternoon have been Marty Verdick and Steve Winterstein of RSM McGladrey. 10 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. Indeed, settlements are in on this Monday after Easter at the Board of Trade. Here are the way they settled at the Chicago Board of Trade in the wheat pit for the afternoon. May futures had a high today of $3.39 a bushel. The low at 3.32, and the May wheat settled at $3.36. They were off 2.5 for the day. The July contract, your harvest month in the soft red winter wheat at the Board of Trade, 3.47 the high. The low at 3.41.5, settlement price there at 3.45.5. They were down a penny and a half for the day. And the September contract at 3.53.5 high. Low at 3.48, settled 3.51.25. Down a penny and three quarters. December contract, 3.60.5, the high, the low at 3.56, settled $3.59, down 1.5 for the day. March contract now, 3.65, the high, the low at 3.61, settlement price at $3.64 a bushel in the March wheat futures, down 1 cent at the Board of Trade. In the corn pit for the day, the May futures in the corn, 2.13.25 high, low at 2.09.25, settled 2.12.75, up 2.25. July contract at 221 high, low at 217, settled 220.5. They were two higher. And the September futures, $2.27.25, the high, the low at 223.75, settled 226.25, a penny and a half higher for the day. December futures, 235.75 high, low at 232.5, settled 234.75, up one. And the March contract in the corn pit, 241.5 the high, the low at 238.75. The March 05, or rather 06 corn, settled $2.40.75, up a penny for the day. May futures, 244.5 the high, the low 242.5, settled 244.25. They were up 1.25. May contract in the oat pit now, 159 the high, low at 156, settled $1.57.25. They were off 1 cent. In July oats, up a half today, 153.25 the high, the low at 50.5, settlement price there at $1.52 a bushel. From the soy complex now, nearby May soybeans, down 3 cents, 6.32 the high, the low at 6.20.5, settlement price $6.25.75 a bushel, down 3 for the May soybeans. July futures, 6.36.5 the high, low at 6.25.5, settlement price there at 6.31.5, they were off 2.5. In the August contract, a 6.34 high, low at 6.23. Settlement price at $6.27.75 of a cent, down 2.75. September futures, 6.13 the high, the low at 6.08. Settlement price at 6.11.5 off 3. And November soybeans, 6.03 the high, the low at 5.96.5, a settlement price at 6.01. And they were down 3 cents for the day. January contract, 6.05 the high, the low at 5.98.5, and a settlement price in the January soybeans at 6.04.5, down a penny and a half for the day. Be sure to stay with us this afternoon when we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. That's not too far away, about the commodity markets and what's been happening at the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. During the closing market report, it all comes up at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time, right here on AM 580 during the closing market report today. Bean meal, the products now for the soybeans, 189 the high for the meal. The low at 185.60 in the May contract, the low at 180, or rather the settlement price at 186.10, and they were down 2.30 for the day. July bean meal, 190.50 the high, the low at 187.20, settled 187.60, down 2.10, and the May bean oil for the day, 23.20 the high. Low at 22.77, settlement price at 22.79, they were down 16. And the July bean oil, 23.30 the high, the low at 22.92, settlement price at 22.97, they were down 12. Let's quickly recap again the numbers from the Board of Trade before we get to those from the Mercantile Exchange. Very quickly, the wheat futures were off anywhere between 2.5 in the nearby to 1 in the far deferreds. The May corn up 2.25, far deferred May a penny and a quarter higher. In your December contract up 1 cent today at 2.34.75 for the new crop corn. Beans down 3 cents in the nearby to penny and a half lower in the far deferred January 2006 contract. And the harvest month 2005 at $6 in the penny, settled down 3 cents for the day. That's the way the numbers looked from the Chicago Board of Trade at the Mercantile Exchange. The numbers were a little different, and here's the way they settled. Celeste Quinn.
Okay, livestock prices higher today, Todd. Let's begin with March feeder cattle, 106.40 the high, 106.30 the low, 106.35 the settlement, that up 2.5. April, 106.40 the high, 105.50 the low, 106.15 the settlement, that up 122.5. May, 105.15 the high, the low, 104 even, the settlement 104.92.5, that up 165. April live cattle, 89.90 the high, 88.85 the low, 89.80 the settlement, that up 145. June 86.05, the high 85.25, the low 85.77 and a half, the settlement, that up 90. April lean hogs, they finish lower today. The only thing with a minus sign there in the screen. Lean hogs, April lean hogs, 70.20, the high 69.30, the low 69.65, the settlement, that down 65. May, 76.80, the high 75.90, the low 76.75, the settlement, that up 32.5. June, 78.60, the high 77.70, the low 78.32.5, the settlement, that up 20. July lean hogs, 76.75, the high, the low 75.97.5, the settlement 76.40, that up 20. March pork bellies, 93.80, the high 91.60, the low, the settlement today 91.92.5, that finishing up 112.5. The Dow up 81 points at 10,524. The NASDAQ 11 higher at 2,002. The S&P 500 up 8 at 1179.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Heather Hunt from Columbus, Ohio writes, Dear Dr. Science, if skin is continually flaking off and new layers replace the old, why don't tattoos wear off?
Contrary to popular belief, tattoos are not merely skin deep. They're actually engraved into the soul of the tattooee, and thus will be with the wearer in the afterlife as well. That's why you should really think before you have the name of your current paramour scratched onto your person. Will you still remember that person fondly in, say, 15,000 years? A tattoo like Born to Lose is the opposite of an affirmation. It's a psychic sentence to a life and afterlife of permanent failure. Sure, there are ways of erasing a tattoo, but it involves the aid of an exorcist as well as a dermatologist.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. To purchase the Duck's Breath 30th Anniversary Show on DVD featuring Dr. Science, Randy of the Redwoods, Ian Scholes, and other classic characters, visit drscience.com.
Chen Tan plays a standard violin in the Oregon Symphony. On her own, she plays one that's a little different. The big difference is how little it is.
A typical child of seven would play on the size instrument. It's about a quarter size instrument.
An introduction to the treble violin today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 Central on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
1 minute before 2 o'clock Central Time, 59 degrees in Urbana. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft, our technical director, today the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Coming up this afternoon on Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio, religion has always had a strong influence on black politics. Our church is now pulling